February 5th, 2025. We got Switch 2 price speculation, EA talk about live service, we got Steam giving early access notices that were very much needed, and so much more here on Super Gamecast Daily. Hello and welcome. This is Super Gamecast Daily. This is where we talk about video game and video game industry news Monday through Friday every week. I am Aaron Reynolds, joined by
I'm Duncan Crabtree.
Yes.
That's me.
How you doing there?
I'm doing great. I'm feeling video games.
Are you feeling video games?
Now.
I'm never feeling video games.
I'm feeling video games.
I did not start this whole thing to talk about video games. I wanted to bring everyone here to talk about how I feel about food.
Yeah, I was thinking about the economic conditions of the plastic production industry.
I would love to hear about it.
Been rubbed into this whole other thing.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Well, we're gonna have to push all that to the side because we actually do have some news. It was a little slow today, but we do have some news here. Starting off with Switch 2 price will, quote, consider the affordability customers expect from Nintendo. So basically in here, Furukawa was on a call or during a Q&A was delivering some thoughts on their financials. And hey, Nintendo has to take into account Japan's increased inflation rate. It also has to consider that the exchange rate environment has changed considerably since the Switch launched in 2017. But they also note they have to consider that our customers expect from Nintendo, or the affordability that our customers expect from Nintendo products. This is, referencing the fact that when you think about like console prices, Nintendo has been aiming low and it has worked out well for them in the past.
Yeah, historically, they're like the go-to budget option for people that want to get some kind of console that don't already have one. Things like the Switch Lite, for example. I know a bunch of people who have gotten Switch Lite that don't usually play video games otherwise. Obviously, the 3DS had a bunch of cheap options out there, the 2DS especially, which, in my opinion, was the best of their line of 3DSs, was the 2DS. Because it just felt so good to hold the like square feeling one. That was the best one in my opinion. This whole story in general is basically, they were asked like, hey, is the Switch gonna be cheap? And he kind of danced around the question, but he's like, yeah, it's probably gonna be cheap. And that's in line with what we've been hearing about the Switch.
Yeah.
Where leaks are staying like somewhere from $350 to $450, and that's pretty cheap in comparison to the other consoles on the market.
So some people were trying to say like, oh, this could reach $500, and there is that question of like, in a world where the prices are going up in not just like consoles but hardware, like Sony has pushed up the price of their PS5s everywhere except here in the United States. They're trying their hardest right now. If Nintendo were to take advantage of that, there's an argument to be made. Would it impact their sales? Maybe.
Here's the thing. If the Switch is $400 and there's a 25% tariff.
You're right. Yes.
That's $500.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe that's the play then. Maybe that's the play. They go cheap. Knowing that there's a good chance tariffs throw everything out of whack, and then they still look like a normal console.
Well, that's only if they're manufacturing out of China, which maybe.
I actually don't know the answer to that question. I am unsure, but I'm, on the one hand, this is like you would say this if you were in his position, like, hey, we need to keep the price is low somewhat so that people can buy this damn thing. At the same time, it's really nice to hear someone in the business end of Nintendo acknowledge like, let's keep this down. Cause like their competitors in their specific market, which is not just consoles, but like the portable consoles, like the Steam Deck. And I think that's a great value for people who enjoy Steam and PC gaming normally. And then you've got, there are other, the ROG Ally and a couple others.
And they're obviously going to be looking to undercut the prices that those are going for right now is yep. basically what they're almost certainly doing. And you know, it is important to consider for them too that the yen has been battered in the past year. It's at like a crazy all-time low in its mm-hmm. value. I mean, that makes traveling there really cheap, but it kind of sucks for people who want to buy things that live there and use that money.
Right. And, you know, it's the Switch, it's Nintendo, it's going to sell everywhere, but you better believe they have Japan in mind, when they're figuring out their business strategy. So
it's always been their strategy of thinking Japan first and just hoping that foreign markets are just also going to like it.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I think we've had conversations numerous times of like Nintendo Switch's online stuff and why it's so yeah. weird. And it's because like the people who are at, especially at the upper end, I imagine, of Nintendo are like, don't be talking to us about how the West online works. We don't do that here.
It's also infamously why their controllers are so small. People have on average smaller hands in Japan by a pretty large margin, and so they make smaller button layouts to accommodate for the audience that they're originally making their consoles for having smaller hands on average. And as a man with tiny hands, I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, okay, so okay, all right, now I'm thinking in a different direction. Screw this news story, I'm thinking something else. I want, like, okay, so mm-hmm. you remember the old DualShocks? Like, they went from yep. PlayStation 1 to PlayStation 2 and 3. It was basically that same, you know, case, that same shell. And then PS4 and 5, they've been having to change. And I've always been thinking in the context of, you know, America, the West, of like, oh, people really like the 360 controller, so clearly they're changing.
They do. They're incredibly popular here.
Yes. And so they're changing their controller to try and mimic that, because to us, or at least to me, the old PlayStation DualShocks, like, they were small, but the idea is you would let them sit in your fingers and you would hold it that way and maybe like press them together with like your knuckles right here, and like right. The point is, yeah,
that was never actually the intent though, right. Because I cannot hold a DualShock that way.
Really? Okay.
I have really small hands.
Okay.
And that's a very uncomfortable way for me to hold a DualShock. I hold it fully in my hand.
Interesting.
The, you know, both of the handles, and that's how I hold all my controllers.
Yeah, I just didn't think of that. So okay, so yeah, and then people in America were complaining about the small size of the controller, and I was like, that's just because you're not holding it right. You're holding it the way Xbox intends to, and there are people with small hands that are like, what the fuck.
Yeah, but actually, as it turns out, it's that hand sizes are literally smaller in Japan, and Sony and Nintendo, both Japanese companies.
Turns out,
available testing markets that they were initially working with were Japanese people who, on average, have smaller hands because they're on average smaller. If you're talking height, it's like an average differential of 3 inches between the average Japanese person and American person.
Right.
And that applies in all categories.
That makes a lot of sense. But now I have a question for you. How do you feel about this PS5 controller?
I have never once held a PS5 controller.
Oh, okay.
I think the best controller ever made is the Xbox Elite Series X2.
Sure. I've heard good things.
I love that controller, and I use it for basically everything.
Okay.
I think it's a good middle ground of size. I think you could probably use it well if you have large hands. And having had small hands, you kind of get used to things being a bit large for you.
I see.
So it's never been an issue.
All right. So, but you're down with the Switch kind of staying what it is.
Yeah, in fact, Joy-Cons are super comfortable for me.
Okay. Fantastic. All right. Well, that's great. I mean, they come... Doesn't the console come with the little adapter that you can slide the Joy-Cons into and hold like a controller? I think that feels fine. Like, it's not a deal breaker for me in any way. So that's mm-hmm. I hope the price stays small, because let me tell you, I got myself a PS5 to get ahead of tariffs. So
but that's what's going on with the Switch 2.
Yes.
But also other stories are happening in the news.
Surprisingly enough, there are other stories going on. You're right. Exactly. Why don't you introduce this one?
EA says that Dragon Age: The Veilguard failed to resonate with a broad audience. Gamers increasingly want shared world features.
Shared world features. Okay. All right.
Now, so, having read this article,
yes.
I would say that the quotes don't as much point to live service as one might think, though definitely the games would be somewhat live service. I think it more so points to like those kind of light interactive features between people. But including that into single player games.
Right.
When they say shared world features, I'm less thinking that it's a game that is like an active exchange between players and more so that like there's shared influence. Think of Helldivers.
Right.
Where the effects of other people playing are not actually huge on you except for the people directly in your game.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of shared world features going on that influence the overall direction of the game. And I'd say that the statements largely look like that in this specific instance, but it does feel like EA as a whole is taking this as a, man, we make so much more money off of live service games than we make off of our single player games. We should do more of that juice.
Right. And then I'm sitting here reading this thinking like this is someone high up at EA that is having to make a call towards investors, and the investors are probably being like, why aren't you making a Fortnite? You should make us a Fortnite. It's like
everybody should make a Fortnite every year.
Yes, all the companies that I'm investing in should make a Fortnite. You know,
except for Fortnite, Fortnite should make a Roblox.
No, Fortnite should make a Rock Band, clearly.
They already did that. Because they're trying to make a Roblox because all other games are in Roblox. They're trying to become the Omni game, that which consumes all and brings the universe to heal.
Which is funny because, yeah, that was what everyone was chasing with Minecraft. You had to make a Minecraft, and then Minecraft was kind of consuming everything. And now it's just Roblox. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you had to make a Minecraft, and then Roblox decided to make a Minecraft that they decided to turn into a Roblox. And they found out that, man, like unregulated gambling and child stock markets and just like, just let everybody do whatever. And then we can just say they did it, not us. Don't wait. They did it. They can do whatever they want in there. We just made it so they could do whatever they want.
Yes.
It makes a lot of money when you make yourself not culpable for the things that are being done in your game.
You make yourself not culpable, but you make sure you get your cut. You know?
You get your cut. You get your
always
upwards of 40% cut of any amount of money that moves through the game. And Fortnite wants to be that, and EA wants Dragon Age to be a Fortnite a little bit.
Or something they have. Like, they you know, EA's got the sports ultimate team stuff. They got people doing trading cards and things like that.
And that's just gacha. They want to put gacha in really hard.
Which, let me tell you, the trends would suggest that would be the way to go. Because, again, like it's funny reading this. The reason we pulled this story is because there has been a backlash within the last year of, like, y'all AAA developers and publishers are putting out too many live service games. First of all, you're making games live service that don't need to be live service. If Lucy were here, we would bring up Marvel's Avengers and talk about that for another 10 minutes, but I'm going to spare you this time. So you're ruining games that could have been, and this, you know, is another one where it was live service, then it got pulled back. How did that affect development? You know, it says here in the article, like, it's a miracle that came out.
And, you know, the BioWare CEO, he was saying that it's a miracle that they were able to even make the game with EA coming in and forcing them to make it from a single player game into a live service game. And then, you know, they completely reshaped the game that they had planned to be effectively a multiplayer game. And they had a bit of that in Dragon Age Inquisition. So it sounds to me like the plan was, hey, that Dragon Age Inquisition multiplayer, let's make a whole game out of that. And then they went, actually, never mind. You can go ahead and make a single player RPG. And so they made the skeleton of a multiplayer game that they then, you know, curved complete 180, go back to a single player RPG. you know, it's disastrously being pulled in every direction.
And then what's so funny is, like, a lot of the controversy around Veil Guard has nothing to do with that. It's that people want it to be the first Dragon Age, which was based off of Baldur's Gate, which Baldur's Gate 3 just came out as a single player thing and is making ridiculous money.
Yeah. I like the first Dragon Age. I would love to have another first Dragon Age. And I did get that with a Baldur's Gate 3. So, you know, that's not an issue.
No, right, exactly.
I feel like a lot of the fans of Dragon Age are disappointed because it feels as though the setting is underutilized, right? There hasn't been a Dragon Age game in a really long time. The setting is interesting and unique. It's definitely a hodgepodge of a lot of existing fantasy tropes, but they put juice in there. They put good juice in there that is not present in a lot of other fantasy media. And people who were really grabbed by Dragon Age want more of that stuff to be present. And it's just been underutilized. They haven't done a lot with the property. And so this game coming out after just a massive labor of a process to not being so great sucks. It sucks. This whole situation sucks for everybody involved.
Well, and it sucks because, like, people have known the problem with Dragon Age for years and voiced it online, and then to find out they're not going in that direction, and they were going in a direction that the business people were probably telling them to, you know, like, hey, live service to make this money, and, like, just a double whammy of awfulness, and they got it out in one piece, and reviewers, as far as I can tell, generally like, yeah, it's fine. Like, okay.
Yeah, it apparently is fine.
It's like, great.
I'll probably play it eventually. But, you know, the real issue comes down to Dragon Age Inquisition being a success, being the worst thing that ever happened to BioWare, as was said by a bunch of people that worked at BioWare, because it was a super rushed, mega crunch nightmare project that came out pretty good, especially financially. Financially, it came out very successful. And so that game being a success was like, all right, I guess we kill people now, right? We make a game.
That's what we do.
And we, like, kill our staff.
This is how
we
make video games, right?
That's the good way to go.
Well, as someone who has not really touched much of Dragon Age at all and don't understand the setting or anything, I'm looking forward to some effort being put back towards Mass Effect. I feel like that's a world that is huge and they could do so much with. Yeah. And it just
You know, BioWare is another one of those settings with a really tough allegory for racism just plopped right in the center of it that they're having a hard time dealing with. So, you know, I expect some more of that when I do inevitably play Veil Guard. There's like 15 fantasy settings out there that have that issue right now, so
yeah, I don't know, we live in a post Detroit Become Human world. Like, you can get pretty blatant for me and I'll be fine, whatever.
It's so funny.
God, dude, it's bad.
My love hate relationship with that game is extreme.
Where is David Cage now? I he's been on my mind. Where is he? Is making something diabolical and I want to know.
Last I heard, he was making that Star Wars game.
Oh no.
Yeah. Quantic Dream was making a Star Wars game that was seemingly going to be a Detroit Beyond Star Wars. Then he was stuck in a million lawsuits because of all the sexual harassment that goes on.
Good, great. Yeah. Well, I'm glad he's in those lawsuits then.
You know, he photoshopped people onto Hitler's face or something and like made giant dicks around the office, sent like naked pictures of people to staff members just because he thought it was funny. Cool stuff. A bunch of cool stuff.
I'm still on the photoshopping Hitler's face
It's been a minute since I've refreshed myself on exactly what it was, but I believe I heard something along those lines, photoshopping people's faces onto other people for gags.
other people, or other people like of the vibe of Hitler, or negative historical people?
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, like, this man cares about trying to craft some sort of story with meaning or something, and he's not good at it, but he clearly cares. But now this has created a whole nother level. What is going on in David Cage's mind? I need to know this. This man.
The man that made Omicron is a mystery to us all.
Well, yeah. All right. Well, that's that story. I want to go to this next story here, because talking about live service trying to make some money out of video games beyond what they already charge you, whether it be an ever increasing base price or their various types of collector's editions, things you can buy. Pokemon Trading Card Game Pocket. Maybe you heard of it. People are crazy about Pokemon cards, and that apparently includes the digital version, because they've estimated to have made $500 million in less than 3 months.
Yeah, I know multiple people who have spent like over $1,000 on that game already. It's so popular.
Okay,
it's like unreal how popular it immediately became.
Yeah,
because it turns out people like the Pokemon trading card game because they played it when they were a kid.
Right.
And it's actually really inaccessible now, but you make a little app that does it, and all of a sudden all of that comes back because it becomes super accessible.
Inaccessible, what do you mean?
Smartly. Inaccessible in that it's complicated.
Yes.
And expensive to get into the Pokemon trading card game now.
All right.
The cards are massively inflated in price because of price speculators. So the sticker price on building a deck just to start playing is like huge for a lot of people. And on top of that, it's a complicated game. And then you have to go to a place in person and like talk to a stranger to play a game with them, and then you probably get bodied, because if you haven't been in it, anyone you could play against has been in it and is crushing you. It's the trading card games have the same problem fighting games have, where you either get in with your buddies and then escalate from there, or you don't get it at all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's stacked on top of the price speculation problem, where it's you get in with your buddies and that costs $400.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you get destroyed if you play anywhere but with your buddies. So it's really unattractive to get into, but fun.
Right.
And there's obviously budget decks that you can build, but like, you know, you don't want to build on a budget.
Right.
You just kind of have to. And, Pokemon TCG Pocket lets you just skip all that.
That's true.
And immediately plies you with a bunch of cards by giving you a bunch of premium currency as you start playing, so that you can buy packs and get cards and build a deck quickly. And it limits the number of cards that exist so that the metagame isn't so complicated. There's, you know, I think it was only 286 cards in their very first launch. And that's a totally reasonable number of cards,
right,
to like manage the meta of. Whereas you're dealing with thousands of cards in the normal TCG.
God, yeah, that's true. Is there a competitive mode? Is that like ranked? Is there like a making sure you're not getting bodied immediately in digital space?
I'm not sure. I'm sure there is a matchmaking system. But I don't actually play it myself. I just have many friends who do.
That's fair. I am very thankful I never got into the competitive aspect of these, and I just like to open the occasional pack and like, oh, I got a Starmie. Wonderful.
Looks like they don't have a ranked playlist. Oof. And people have discussed whether or not there should be a ranked playlist for the game.
Right. Huh. Okay.
But that's just the result of a quick Google search. But yeah, so it's a lot easier to get into, and very nostalgic. And Pokemon has had literally decades to perfect getting people hooked on opening packs. Yeah. And all of those things that have made opening packs fun for people, you know, the existence of stuff like God packs where you open a pack and it's like $3,000 worth of cards existing, and then you getting these videos that are people freaking out with their reactions to opening a God pack. That's stuff that they learned from the physical trading card game, and they very effectively implemented in TCG Pocket. All the same things that can happen when you're opening actual card pack can happen in TCG Pocket as well. And so you have those moments of being like, oh, it's the full art Eevee. I've been wanting this Umbreon. It's amazing. And that is really addictive. And it's gotcha. It's gotcha.
But right.
What people don't realize is that the people who have been doing gacha for way longer than gacha has existed is TCG companies, and Pokemon gets to pull that juice
right
straight into this game off rip. They don't have a learning period of learning the balance of how you need to make things happen to get people to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, it's Pokemon. You want to talk about like one of the biggest, most popular IPs you could possibly ask for.
The biggest, most popular.
Is it number one? Yeah, I figure it's number one. Yep.
Bigger than Marvel, bigger than DC. It's Pokemon, Marvel, DC is the order of most popular media franchises of all time. Or profitable.
Yep. And it's from stuff like this. Like, it's kind of wild how you'll see the mainline game that's introducing new Pokemon and new regions and new characters that people will you know fall in love with, and the game's fucking broken, and then here's a trading card game, a digital trading card game, and it just bonkers.
Well, this is the reason that the main games are broken. The main games come out broken because they're on a super tight schedule, because they need the game to come out on time. Because they have like a year and a half of preparation prior of, this is going to be the company producing the dolls. This is going to be the company producing the shirts. This is going to be what we're going to do in the TV show. This is going to be, you know, they've got all of that laid out mid development.
Mm-hmm.
And so if development misses, you're not just delaying the game, you're delaying like dozens of contracts you have with other manufacturers and other companies that are working in the whole media franchise.
Right.
And so, you know, they look at Game Freak and they're like, I don't care what you do, make the game come out on this day.
And it's weird because I don't know what the development team makeup is like, but I have to imagine a lot of these people are coming from, you know, DS, 3DS. And it's like, all right, you're Switch developers now. Figure it out.
Yeah. They pretty openly have had a hard time with the transition to 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Even on the 3DS. I mean, you know, X and Y and Sun and Moon still aren't super great with working with 3D. There's a lot of problems that come with the Pokemon models.
They've had with those models. Oh my god.
Because, you know, the jump from Black and White to X and Y, a lot of Pokemon just look worse, like way worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a consequence of the fact that, they're not used to 3D and they don't know how to make everything look good in 3D.
Yeah.
And now they're working with full consoles and they're all of a sudden they're being asked to develop in HD, which is something they've never done before. And, they've had a limited staff for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to not want to overinflate Game Freak.
Well, so that's the thing is like, I'm sorry, you guys are Pokemon. You are bigger than the COVID, you know, inflation of your workforce and losing money. You're Pokemon. You can add people. Like, I don't know.
Absolutely.
I think you just had, if you had your core Game Freak team that is about developing what the Pokemon world is, and then you have your workhorses that are built around, they could make something happen. But
if I were to speculate, I would say that it is likely a case of management not wanting too many different creative influences to enter the team than what they already have.
Right.
And not having the experience or history with managing a large enough team to get to the size of a team that would develop a more ambitious version of Pokemon on the timelines that they want. And so they're kind of just settling with, we're going to get better at this and we're going to release a couple Pokemon games that aren't finished.
And the games sell anyway. You know, I'm buying them. They excel at the thing that I want, which is they make a neat little region. They make some neat little Pokemon. They've been really doing really well with the character designs. I really like the characters that they've been making.
I like Goldengo. He's still a little guy.
He's just a little guy.
Give me Ghoul.
They made a Pokemon and called it Vavavroom. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's great.
Good. So,
I mean, they did that a long time ago, too.
Yeah, you know. Well, that's the thing. This was a generation where they topped over 1,000. I'm like, all right, you guys can stop. Like,
yeah.
I can't bother anymore. I remember...
No, but actually you can't stop, and I'm still upset that you didn't include all 1,000 in your newest game.
Yes, also, this goes back to you could hire the workforce necessary to develop all the, at least the models, like get all that stuff done. I know implementing all the stats and everything. And then balancing it, you know, could be something. But
the balance is actually the real problem, honestly, yeah. I think. As I've learned more about competitive Pokemon, I've gotten interested in it lately.
Mm-hmm.
There are things like, for example, Shedinja. Shedinja is not in the current games. And the reason Shedinja is not in the current games is because the terrestrialization mechanic would make him like insanely unreasonably powerful.
Oh.
It would you give a Shedinja with obviously the ability Wonder Guard that he is famous for,
mm-hmm.
The electric terrestrialization along with the item Air Balloon, and he becomes an electric type and can't be hit by ground attacks. So he is not weak to anything, which means no attacks can hit Shedinja at all.
Great. Good.
And so what do you do? Like, what do you do about that situation?
Shedinja does not exist.
So, yeah, just don't put him in the game. Just
gone.
We don't want that mechanic and that Pokemon to exist at the same time.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm on
that, and they...
Yeah.
They keep doing this thing where they go, we're going to make our models for the next game so that we can reuse them. And then they go, but like, we actually can't really reuse all of
them. It's absolutely insane that happens. I don't understand that at this point. I understand making that mistake once, but like, come on.
But three times
it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, I could go on about talking about Pokemon. I've considered starting a Pokemon-centric podcast, and that's someone who's not even into competitive Pokemon. That's someone who's not into... I play Pokemon Trading Card Game Pocket. I do it to do the thing where you open the card pack, and it's like, oh, you got the card. Look at this holographic card. I'm going to move it left and right and make it shine, and then I'm going to stick that in my little booklet, and that's that. Fantastic.
Yep.
That's all I need. But... we actually ended up spending all this time talking about Pokemon. The thing I wanted to point out is we had that Veil Guard story where people are chasing live service for their money. And I know this is Pokemon. It's going to make a ridiculous amount of money. But I'm sitting here like, if you work on trying to make something like attractive and like trading card games, like a trading card game, and then gotcha with attractive ladies.
Like, that's what they're effectively doing, except with attractive soccer players at EA.
I know, but it's not... First of all...
Upwards of 70% of their live service profits comes from the FIFA gacha.
Right. Which, again, like, yeah, that's fantastic. But, like, you could be expanding that beyond sports. There are people who love... I found out in where I live now, there is a store dedicated to selling sports trading cards.
Yeah.
Nuts to me that's mm-hmm. a business that is paying its bills and continuing to go. There's this whole world that I don't
know.
Yeah, there's this whole world that I'm not aware of. I think it's really cool that it does, but I'm just like, wow. You want to talk about like trying to drum up a way to like, if your interest is in making money, there are people who seem to be into this, like the trading card stuff and the gacha stuff. Like,
well. A big part of the issue that comes with implementing that in other markets is that if you look at like Star Wars, mm-hmm. right, when Battlefront 2 remake came out, they tried to implement a lot of microtransaction stuff, and that community was very, very resistant to it. It wasn't gacha stuff, but they were heavily resistant to it on grounds of it being advantage-based microtransactions.
Right.
And gacha doesn't work without advantage-based microtransactions.
Right.
It's like all the biggest gacha games have advantages for having better characters, and that's what makes the characters attractive. And the people who are really, really into the game either want to have sex with the characters or really want to do the biggest number, and spending money is how you get that.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I think the number one reason people find a character attractive is their fat ass. I think.
Yeah, you know, it helps.
If you make a gacha Star Wars game and then give Rey Skywalker a fat ass, I think it'll do all right.
The thing is that you get games like Honkai Star Rail.
Yes.
Which they make a bunch of money because they release a character like Firefly, and she comes out and she does the biggest number and has the fattest ass. At the same time,
it's all we need.
Yeah, you pair those, and it's just free money. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not free; you have to develop the art asset, but it's proportionally a lot of money.
You do have to do some work. If you're going to make a trading card game, you got to make sure like it works well enough and doesn't just freaking break.
Exactly, you got to make people want to keep playing it,
right?
And Pokemon can do that really easily, and I think EA has a hard time doing that because a lot of the IP that they have access to has people that are resistant to this genre of microtransaction. Gacha players play gacha games.
Yes.
They don't play other existing things as much as you would expect them to. Obviously, a lot of them are gamers, but they're not going, ooh, there's a Star Wars gacha game, let me go play that. They're playing the gacha game, and they're associating that from the start with the microtransactions, so it's not intruding upon something they already like.
Well, I mean, what if you just come out with a Star Wars gacha game, and from the moment it's like, this is a gacha game, but it's Star Wars, and not putting your microtransactions and all your shit into something like Battlefront that is already established as a certain experience?
I'm pretty certain they actually already do have that. They have a mobile game that is like insanely gacha, like filled. But it's just not as successful because the audience that wants to play Star Wars games is not the audience that is looking to get gotcha'd. Some of them are, which is why that mobile game exists.
Right. I don't know. I'd have to look. Clearly, I need to do some more research on this subject.
On gotcha.
Yeah.
You're right. You do need to play a game with girls with fat asses.
I already do. It's Endless Zone Zero, and it burnt me the fuck out because I'm not spending money on the game, and I'm just leveling these characters and being like, it's another room to fight three guys.
And because you're not spending money, the characters have smaller asses.
That's how it works. You know, it's very subtle.
They have a spider. They shrink it. Dependent on the amount of money you pumped into the game.
Man, don't give them ideas.
It's the stealth mechanic.
Oh, shit. No, we can't let them find out. All right. We're going to move on to the next story here. This one won't take very long because it's basically just maintaining the status quo. But UK government rejects calls to prohibit disabling of live service games. There was a petition. They got 10,000 signatures. It was an online petition to prohibit publishers irrevocably disabling video games they have already sold. This is a problem. I think the most notable is The Crew, but this has been happening with other games, and it's going to happen more as more games go online only.
Yeah.
And development and people have to move on to other projects.
In the article, they make reference to Concord, which has immediately imploded, and Multiverses, which has recently had a resurgence in popularity as the game has been announced that it's going to be shutting down in its fifth season.
And got its update that like sped its gameplay up, which people were asking for. And now you're getting it after it's going down.
It's crazy that they had an early launch on that game for people to like test it. And then took it down.
Yep.
And then made the game worse.
Yep.
And then released it. Like, people liked Multiverses already before the game came out.
You were doing great.
And then they took it offline and made it bad and then re-released it to, like, negative fanfare.
It's the one of the most baffling things I've seen in recent years. Like, that's something that, like, I don't think anyone's addressed that in the wake of this game, you know, winding down. But I think that's the biggest question. That's the biggest question in Multiverses is, first of all, why'd you make the game worse in your comeback? And then why didn't you immediately change it back to what you had before? Because people like that more. But also, why did you take it down in the first place? Why are you taking down something people are already spending money on? You're already getting headlines. Like, what are you...
It was evidently just some crazy internal management situation that was just super messed up.
That's the... that's
probably
what I get,
also but... rights related. You know, they have really big characters in there, and they had plans to include a lot of even bigger characters.
But that wouldn't require taking like, down, right? That's just like managing the game you got.
No, but it requires a ton of negotiation.
Sure.
And people really wanting to buy time to work out deals, even though it was all IP that the company has access to.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a bunch of people you got to get permission from.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. It's just
probably something along those lines. Some context that the actual article is missing here is that this whole initiative to get the UK to look into this in particular with the crew was started by a YouTuber, Accursed Farms, who made a series that was popular on Machinima back in the day called Freeman's Mind, and does a lot of classic game reviews. He also is like radically anti the death of games. He's a huge video game preservationist guy.
Okay.
And so he started this petition and this whole movement to get any countries, really. They're working on a bunch of different countries in the EU, but in particular the UK was the most promising because it's a very large market.
Right.
To get them to either amend their laws in such a way that it would prevent the closing of games like this, or to enforce existing laws in such a way to prevent the closing of games like this. And the UK effectively came out in response and said no.
Yeah, they were like, we understand this is a problem. We think our current laws deal with this, and the current laws are like, it's their stuff. I don't know what you want us to do.
I know there's a popular creator, Pirate Software, that was vehemently opposed to the movement in general. There is opposition to this in that a lot of people think it will have negative effects on specific genres like MMOs. It's kind of the way that the approach that these game preservationist groups are using also overlaps in such a way that it would make it difficult to run the common MMO without it being against the rules effectively.
What do you mean? Like, I'm trying to figure out what the problem is.
So MMOs kind of require that you have live service.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yes.
The genre itself can't be molded into an offline version of the game. They are I'd say an origin version of the live service game, because they're literally live updated and live developed. And those experiences would have such a burdensome requirement to make sure that all of that content is accessible perpetually, that those games wouldn't be viable to release in markets that require that you make it impossible for your game to be completely inaccessible.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
And that's the arguments that groups that oppose the law have made. Whereas groups that want to, you know, these preservationist groups, they care more about the preservation effectively.
Right.
I'd say I lean towards that side. I think it's more important that the preservation of games be maintained than it is to protect the hyper-specific and coincidentally very profitable form of video game expression that can't be done in a situation in which the game is forced to be permanent.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't get it. And there are people who are, you know, there are people who are running City of Heroes servers right now. There are people who are running like dead the online video games illegally.
And that's,
I guess,
a counterpoint that people often bring up.
Yeah.
Is that you don't necessarily need to make it so that the game is running infinitely. You just need to make it possible for people to access the game.
Yep.
Even theoretically, if you release development files such that people are able to start a server of the game on their own privately, then that's absolutely fine. In fact, World of Warcraft, which is the common example, a common example of an MMO that would theoretically not be possible, has a million private servers out there that people play on. And those have been, you know, reverse engineered from other versions of the game than the current version. Effectively, what that requirement would do for MMOs is force them to release the files required to run your own version of the game, which they really, really, really don't want it to, because that means publicly releasing development assets,
right?
Which companies love to hoard. They need to have every single penny worth of any kind of asset they can possibly hold on to.
Yeah. Yep. So this goes back to corporations, big groups wanting to have as much money as possible, and sometimes that means hoarding things in case they make money from it later, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's a bummer of a bit a news story, but also not surprising where things are at right now. Hopefully we get more game preservation in the future, because these games are cool. Like the idea of Final Fantasy 14 ending for like a newer Final Fantasy MMO, and then just like no servers, nothing, like can't access this thing that shaped people's lives.
That happened in Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
1.0.
Can't play 1.0.
Was terrible.
Yep.
And was completely annihilated in favor of A Realm Reborn.
Yep.
Because they went, the game existing at all is just not worth it.
Right. And thankfully, in that case, I think everyone's pretty fine with it. But, you know, that's not the case, you know, for everyone.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. Oh,
it'd be cool if people could play 1.0 just to see how it was.
Yes, exactly. Again, this is bad. Got it. Understood.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
In the next story.
Oh, this is our last bummer, so.
Once more, mm-hmm. You can reset the counter. We've got some layoffs.
Woo!
This time, 66 employees at Iron Galaxy Studios. Laid off.
Execute order 66.
Yep. They famously are a company that works on a bunch of games in co-development. So they've worked on Call of Duty, The Last of Us, Uncharted, Elder Scrolls, Fallout, Destiny, Bioshock, and Killer Instinct. They had more than 250 employees in 2022, and they have since. They initially had plans to hire even 100 more, and they've since had a rough times, as they've said, and they've been slowly laying people off until they really just couldn't take it anymore and did the big release, the climax, if you will, releasing 66 employees, downsizing significantly.
Oh, this is a bummer because Iron Galaxy is a fantastic game studio. They've been kicking around for years. They helped bring us Dive Kick, and they were huge in bringing back Killer Instinct, which people have been asking for more Killer Instinct in this this revival of the fighting game genre that Street Fighter VI and Tekken 8 have been leading.
From what I understand, that game has limped along for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I want to say this game came out before, definitely came out before Strive, Guilty Gear Strive.
Oh, absolutely, way before.
Yeah, I was kind of not doing my games coverage during this period of time, so I'm trying to remember when which was released. But like, this came out when fighting games were like, you know, so the people have been wanting this. So seeing them hurt, not just as the Killer Instinct developers, but also
2013.
Yeah, 2013. Yep. No, they were way 12 back.
Years ago.
Yes. God, 12. It's 12 now. Yeah. Uh-huh. And the fighting games are better than ever before. People are playing Marvel 2 on modern consoles. People are about to get a new, City of the Wolves. Like, people are... fighting games are this is the time, man. And and then these guys are helping put together a number of huge games that AAA developers and publishers are relying on, so seeing them get hit is a real bummer.
A fun little anecdote the article gives us is that over 1 in 10 developers who participated in a recent GDC survey said they were laid off over the past year.
Mm-hmm.
10%.
Video games have never made more money than they are right now, and we are also experiencing so many layoffs. It's good. It's good and healthy and good.
We love firing people. It's so good for everything. Can I get a little more firing people, please?
Coming right up.
As a treat for me.
Oh, we can provide so much more for you. Here we go. Let's go. No. All right. So good luck to everyone who got friggin' laid off. I know Iron Galaxy as a dev studio are cool people. So when they say it was a last resort, I believe them.
They do seem and they said they really want to support all their former employees in finding new employment, and that they're all really great, and that anyone who has any opportunities should definitely reach out, as they're all fantastic developers.
Yeah. So shame. That was the last bad news story. This one's actually sort of mixed, but it's a good thing overall. Steam has early access, right? Now they've added an update, because some people are putting their games into early access and then not updating them, and then it's like early access forever, and that can lead you to think, hey, this game will get better eventually if you're not paying close attention to what the developer is doing. So they are now adding notation in the early access bit here, as you can see. The last update made by the developers was over 18 months ago is the example here. Nice contrasting font color to the blue to make sure it catches your eye.
Big warning.
It's right in that where it says early access game, and then it why early access, and then it explains what's going on. And now at the top of that, they have a note saying like, this was when it was last updated. And so I don't know. That's been huge, because a lot of games have been going into early access, and then you kind of have to wade into the comments and be like, all right, is this being delivered on? Like, people are buying or paying full money for this stuff.
There's a number unknown to God nor man of completely abandoned early access video games just sitting there on Steam and on other platforms. They're everywhere. They're constantly coming around. And so this is an obviously great change.
Yes.
That people can go, hey, by the way, you could buy it, but you're not getting anything more.
Right. It's almost a shame that Supergiant Games released Hades into early access and then delivered and became game of the year for multiple publications. And now it's like, well, all right. It's a legitimate strategy. It's a way to get funding for your game. Yeah, it makes sense. It just... It's the people who let go.
It's excessively exploitable. It's so, so easy to exploit.
Yep.
It is so easy to scam people with early access games.
Yep. I learned my lesson early in the before times, before early access, in the Kickstarter era.
Wait, let me guess. Mighty Number 9.
Got it. Yep.
Yeah.
Put $20 in that thing. Because it's the guy who created Mega Man and Mighty Number 9. That's a fun name. Look at this art. This looks fun. And then you're watching the development, and you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, where'd it go?
Oh, boy. Well, damn.
I mean, the game came out.
It came out! It did.
Came out.
There's
a game called Mighty Number 9.
It's which, you know what? That is more than a lot of developers promising, you know, Kickstarters and stuff like that.
I mean, a lot of people don't even mean to scam their audience, too. They just go, I'm going to make the biggest game ever made, and it's going to be Kingdoms of Mega Huge, and everyone is going to have land, and it's going to be the size of the planet Earth, maybe 1.5 times the size of the planet Earth.
Uh-huh.
And it's all going to be simulated. And then, you know, they get $650,000. And that's nowhere near enough money to do that. And then they release an early access like tech demo.
Yep. And things just get out of hand.
They didn't mean to. They just burned through all of that money, because it turns out it's really expensive to make video games.
Do you know how Star Citizen is doing?
It exists. People play it.
It's being played.
It has a cult-like following. Yeah, it is not being played, so it's not done. It's nowhere near done.
Well, okay. All right. But people are paying money, buying these ships and playing this game that is never going to be finished.
They are still paying a lot of money for just like the most expensive things. And there's like a lot of different modes of play. Like there is like the simulated world part where like you can get your ship stolen and stuff. And like there's, you know, that exists. And then there's also there's development on like Squadron 42, which is supposed to be their connected FPS that is not connected, but it's in development. It's a game that will never be finished. And right. the community that exists around Star Citizen now is a group of people who are convinced that you're crazy if you think it'll never be finished, and also don't really mind that it isn't finished.
That's the real thing at this point. Look, at the end of the day, if you're enjoying it and you're not like paying out the ass, like it's fine. Okay, like
give me your bag a little bit out the ass. That ship is $15,000, but you wanted it. So you can have what you want.
If I was gonna get that invested in a space game and like start spending some real money, I would just rather go over to EVE Online, where there's some like fucked up shit happening over there.
Yeah, EVE Online is like wildly inaccessible, though.
That's true. Yeah,
and also they don't actually want you spending real money.
Oh,
on EVE Online. EVE Online is actually in the same position that a lot of other major MMOs are in, where you can spend real money on an in-game currency that gives you game time.
Right.
And you can trade that in-game for in-game money. And they, like everyone else who is doing that, probably did that as a concession because they really don't like it when people are spending real money for the in-game currency and they don't get any of that cut.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a way to buy it through them instead of through other people because you're going to buy it anyway. But they're still nowhere near the level of Star Citizen that has the Legatus 2953 ship bundle for $48,000. The most expensive ship in EVE Online is not as expensive as Star Citizen's most expensive bundle.
You can just pay someone's bills for a year, man. Why don't you do that instead?
Now, EVE Online also has this issue where it doesn't matter how much money you're spending, because that's not going to like get you real people's support.
Yeah.
And you can have all the nice ships you want. Mm-hmm. You need pilots for them.
Right.
So, that's true. Unless you're going to be paying salaries for pilots, that real money's not going to get you as far as you might think.
Right. Oh, God. Video games are messed up.
Yeah. EVE Online in particular EVE is Online, incredibly definitely. Messed up.
Yeah.
People do real crimes over that game.
Right. Yes. So, but we're not going to get into that. We're just about out of time, but I want to share one last little bit of news story. Rooster Teeth is back?
He's back.
Bernie Burns bought it?
He bought it. He bought it. He was doing some other stuff for a while, and everybody kind of lost track of him because, you know, whatever, he went and left. And I guess he was mildly successful on its own. And then Rooster Teeth nuclear exploded and was gone.
Yep.
And then he made a little funny video where he was like, "Guys, I'm back from getting milk. Where is everybody?" So he's going to do that again.
Yeah, he's going to do that again. It sounds like they're going to try and make kind of like the pillars of what they had before everything started going downhill.
I first started listening to Rooster Teeth content when I was in elementary school.
Okay.
I started watching Red vs. Blue as I think like a 9-year-old.
Man.
And so It was a big influence on me growing up watching Red vs. Blue,
yeah,
and Achievement Hunter stuff, and And then a bunch of terrible things happened. And then there was a pedophile in the mix, and there was a guy doing sex stuff at the office he wasn't supposed to do.
God.
And then it turns out they were pretty laissez-faire about racism, and there was that whole thing with Micah Burton, who was like, you guys only want me here because of my dad, because you're really, really cool with this racism stuff going on. So they had their fair share of issues, which is part of why people like Bernie left the company, and a lot of old figures left the company. Ray Narvaez Jr., a popular streamer who was working for Rooster Teeth for 2 years in Achievement Hunter, has had his entire career plagued by people constantly asking him if he's ever going to do anything with Rooster Teeth again, for the longest time.
Damn.
So it's cool to see them maybe coming back. He stated online, hey, don't bother all the old people who work for Rooster Teeth, because I'm not going to like go after them to get them all back.
Right.
Let them do their own thing.
Yes, exactly. People have moved on. So I don't know. I know there are a lot of people who followed like Rooster Teeth, the larger project and all of its, you know, podcasts and shows and all that. I was mostly just a Red versus Blue guy. So, and that kind of, for me, went wild a long time ago. And I lost track.
I was obsessed with Ruby for like a period of like 2 years.
Oh, sure. Yes. No, there was a time when that was on. People loved Ruby.
And then Monty Oom died and it got less good.
Yes. Yes. Ugh. Bummer. But hey, Rooster Teeth's coming back. Maybe we'll get some more cool stuff later.
Yeah.
Good news. So anyway, that is our show for today for SGK Daily. Thank you so much for joining us. We do this every weekday, Monday through Friday. Monday through Thursday, it's 6:30 Pacific. And then on Fridays, it will be 9 Pacific PM. And you'll be able to check us out there. We're streaming live on Twitch at twitch.tv/supergamecraft. You can find our YouTube channel where we'll be archiving that. We'll get a few clips up. We'll throw that on there. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We're all over the place. We got socials, which hopefully you've been seeing during the stream here.
We're on the other side of the moon. There's a little broadcast on the other side of the moon. You can't see it because it's all the way over there, but
yeah,
it's there.
Don't trust us, it's over there. If you were,
and you can't prove me wrong.
No, you can't. So anyway,
go do it, I dare you.
Hey, so we'll be live tomorrow, Thursday, February 6th, 2025, and
tomorrow.
We hope to see you there. Otherwise, have a fantastic rest of your week, everyone. Bye.